Amen. Thank you so much. It's great to be with you tonight. And I've got a question for you. I wonder if you've ever had that experience of realizing that you've misjudged someone. So you had an impression on them based on what other people had said about them, what you'd read about them, maybe what you'd seen about them, their reputation, and then you actually have a conversation with that person and you realize you didn't have the full picture. They're quite different from what you expected. I've had that experience. I was born and bred in a beautiful town just north of London called Luton, and people always laugh when I say, Luton's a town which at first, I mean, gets a bad press. I think it's because it's a town which at first glance appears to have very few redeeming features. But let me tell you, I lived there for 22 years. Let me tell you, when you scratch beneath the surface, it has none, actually. But I'm very fond of it. I love my hometown. And I went to quite a rough school there, and it was known as the worst school in Luton. It's not anymore, actually, because they knocked it down. And it was a pretty dangerous place, and particularly for someone like me, because I quite liked reading. I liked Shakespeare. I thought Dickens was a good read. And in our school, that meant the teachers liked me, and that basically was the kiss of death. Plus, the problem was that I played the trumpet, the violin, and the euphonium. And let me tell you, when you're carrying a euphonium, you can't run that fast. So it was a little bit of a tricky place to be. But at our school, there was a guy who struck terror into the hearts of everyone, not just people like me with trumpets, but everyone. And his name was Clint. Some people are born to write poetry. Some people are born to sing songs. Clint was born to fight. Like, he could fight people 5 years older than him and win. He could fight whole gangs and win. The guy was enormous. He was huge. He was astonishingly aggressive. And when he walked the corridors of our school, people ran and hid. And if you're listening to this online, Clint, I just want you to know I'm so happy you're out of prison. And I want you to know I've always been a huge admirer of yours and your work and everything about you. That's just for my own personal safety when I head back home. One day, he was walking through the school doing his thing, and I was carrying my violin case with my violin inside it, not just the case. And he kind of came up to me and squared up to me, and I thought, oh, this is it. Like, this is it. Your whole life flashes before your eyes. And he said, Foster, because that's my surname. I mean, he said, Foster, you play the violin. And I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. I mean, it was like, I'm thinking, do you want me to play the violin? Does that offend you in some way? Because I'm not precious about it. I can stop. I'm not especially good at it. But all I could do, I was so scared, was I just said, yes, like this. And then he said something I wasn't expecting. He said, I want to learn to play the violin. And I was like, he said, you've got to help me, yeah? And I went, he said, Safe, you help me with this, I'll look after you, and if anyone gives you trouble, you come to me. And I was like, and then he walked away, and I kind of was standing there thinking, huh, I'm alive? And that wasn't what I expected. Like, I completely misjudged the guy. Like, I mean, I thought he was just hugely violent, but actually had this untold passion to play the violin. I mean, who would have expected it? And tonight, I just want to talk about one short, random conversation which completely changes someone's view of someone else. I just want to look at one conversation someone had with Jesus. And you might think Jesus is irrelevant. How could someone who lived 2,000 miles away, 2,000 years ago, have any impact on your life? Surely Jesus was just a religious figurehead. You might have some sort of negative reaction to Jesus. You might think, well, it's the kind of reaction my little brother Paul has when he sees a police car. Like, here's someone who's going to make me feel guilty and stop my fun. It's funny if you know Paul, but this conversation suggests there's far more to Jesus than we might have seen. He does the completely unexpected and is completely unshockable. So the conversation is in John chapter 4. Is that like a bell ringing somewhere? Oh, great, okay. It feels like it's like 47 o'clock. So Jesus has this conversation with a Samaritan woman by a well. And Jesus was Jewish, and Samaritan people didn't speak that much. So it was an unusual conversation. It happened in the middle of the day, and it happened by a well. And we're going to pick up the story. This is in John's account of Jesus' life in chapter 4. There are some Bibles around on the floor. I don't know what page it is in those Bibles, but I'm sure you'll be able to find it. It's about 1/6 of the way through your Bible, and Jesus has this conversation. So when a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and this well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, and also his sons and his livestock?" Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." He told her, "Go, call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you've had 5 husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you've said is quite true." "Sir," the woman said, "I can see you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place we must worship is in Jerusalem." "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshippers must worship in the spirit and in truth." The woman said, "I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, I am he." Everything Jesus does in this incident is unexpected. He's in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong person. He's chatting to a Samaritan. He's chatting to a woman on his own, which was unusual in the custom of that time. They're at the well at midday. Going to the well at midday is like going to the water cooler at work or the JCR when no one else is there, or, you know, going to your student common room when no one else is there because you've done something you deeply regret the night before and you're ashamed and embarrassed and you just hope you won't have to see someone. It's like going to the water cooler at the middle of the day because you just hope that everyone else won't be there. It's like going to grab a coffee when you don't think anyone else will be around. Jesus does stuff that just isn't expected. You don't expect him to be there. When I was ordained, when I was made a vicar, there was a big service at St. Paul's Cathedral. There were 2,000 people, lots of important people in robes. There was beautiful architecture, classical music. There was a choir. And you might think that's the sort of place you'd expect someone like Jesus to be. Very respectful, very important, very safe, very above board. After the service, I'd organise some drinks with some mates at a bar across the road, and I was late because it takes a while to get out of everything, but I still had some of my kind of black vicar shirt and my white little collar thing on. I should know the words, I don't. And everyone had been in the bar for a while, so I just kind of rushed in as quick as I could into the middle of this bar, and I suddenly found I was in the midst of lots of young women in their 20s and 30s, and one of them said, "Here he is," and they all cheered. And I looked at them, and actually, if I'm honest, I didn't recognize them, but there had been like 2,000 people at the service, and I thought, well, maybe I know them from somewhere. I didn't want to be rude. And then one of them leaned forward, and she said, are you actually a vicar? And I thought, that's a strange question, because they'd obviously just seen me at my service. So I said, yeah. And then they got really excited, and I thought, that's strange, because I'm quite excited I've become a vicar, but you're more excited about this even than I am. And then I kind of paused for a second. I looked around the group and I suddenly thought, this is a hen party. And then I realized they hadn't asked me, are you a vicar? They'd asked me, are you a stripper? slightly embarrassing. And then I looked over and all my friends were at the bar kind of waving at me, just saying, we're here, this is funny. In a strange way, that second situation is much closer to what's going on in this passage. Somewhere you would never expect Jesus to be. By a water cooler, by a well, in the middle of the day, with a woman who's had a very difficult life. But yet there he is. He's there. You know, in spite of the gender barrier, you know, in spite of the moral barrier, in spite of the cultural barrier, it's Jesus who starts the conversation. He's not put off by any of that. He just wants to connect with the person. And he asks for a drink, which in itself is unexpected. And the woman is shocked, and she's kind of saying, well, how can you ask for a drink? Look at me. Look at you. Look at where we are. Look at what's going on here. You're asking me for a drink? But Jesus keeps going. He says, if you really know who is speaking to you, you'd ask for living water. He's only just met her, but he seems to know what her greatest need is. Not for water which satisfies her thirst for a few hours or a few days, but for the rest of her life and beyond. Living water. I was reading recently in the newspaper an interview of Leonardo DiCaprio, or Leo as I know him. And he said in this interview, he said, you know, you can have great wealth and great success, but they don't bring happiness ultimately. And when I read something like that, I want to say, Leo, let's just switch places for a week. You can have my life, I'll have yours, and I'll see. I mean, you might be right, but I want to give it a try first. You know, I at least want to give it a shot, because I might be happier with it than you are. You know, if you're finding it really hard, earning millions of pounds and flying around the world in private jets, just let me try. And the interviewer said the same thing. They said, come on, Leo, come on. And he said, I'm being honest with you. Those things don't satisfy you. And I don't know, you might have experienced it, that you can have lots of good things in your life. They're not necessarily bad things, but you long for something more. It's almost like you feel a spiritual thirst, and you try and satisfy it with whatever, with more parties, with a better group of friends, with more money, more success at work, more relationships. And that's what I've tried to do over the years. There's been times in my life when I've gone after all of those things, but however much of them I have had, and at times I've had a lot, I've always wanted more. And there's almost been this deep sense within me that I could have 10 times as much of all those things, but they're not going to ultimately satisfy me. It feels almost like, I don't know if you've had this sense, that you've got an infinite thirst and you're trying to satisfy it with finite things. It's like no matter how much you pour in, it's never going to fill you up. And I know you're doing a series on the Sabbath, but when you're in that place, actually it's quite hard to rest, to truly rest, to find peace, because your thirst drives you on. It drives you on to consume more, to get more, to be more active, to try more activity. The idea of stopping for a day is crazy. You would never do that because you need to accumulate more, you need to achieve more, you need to do more. And that's why the Sabbath is such a powerful, countercultural, remarkable thing, to trust God that he can do more through you in 6 days than you can do on your own in 7. That's the promise of the Sabbath, and it's a remarkable thing. It's an act of obedience and an act of trust. And that's how I just found I wasn't going to be satisfied. And then, even though I had lots of questions, lots of doubts, I knew I needed a different type of water. And when I tasted it, I'm drinking lots of, it's like a visual aid at the moment. I'm just reminding you that this is what I'm talking about. Just, this is like a visual parable now. When I tasted it, I knew that it was so refreshing. There was such a deep sense of peace within me. And that's what Jesus offers here. On a well, on the outskirts of a town, to a woman he's just met. And it's completely unexpected. Jesus is not only completely unexpected, though, he's also completely unshockable. I wonder if you think of Jesus in that way. I once went with some of my work friends to a nightclub. I don't spend all my time in nightclubs. That just happens to be the theme of tonight. And it was amazing. And we had a great time because one of my friends had actually represented the owner of all the network of nightclubs. So we were kind of treated like VIPs. We were kind of ushered in, private area, very exciting. You know, they're just pouring champagne for us, cocktails. It was great fun. And then we got chatting to some people, and I was chatting to this young woman who came over and started chatting to us. And we started talking about faith. And after a while, she said to me, I've always been fascinated by the idea of faith. I've always been fascinated by it, she said, but it's not for people like me. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, if you knew the places I'd been and the things I'd done, the people I've hurt, you'd know it wasn't for people like me. In fact, if you knew all those things, you wouldn't even want to speak to me. And I think her comment really keys into something, a real issue in our culture. Because we're desperate for relationships which are real and which we can trust. And we're wary of anything which seems fake. I don't know if that's something you've experienced. That's something we're really wary of. And deep down, we long for love and acceptance, but we fear rejection. Because if we're honest, we know there's a mix of good and bad in all of us. We know we can't really experience real love until we reveal who we are, but the real fear is that when people see us for who we really are, without any airbrushing, without any presentation on our behalf, they'll walk away from us. So we put up a front which saves us, you know, from rejection, because the fear is if we're rejected for who we really are, that would be devastating. So we long to know that which is real and true, but yet we find it hard to be real and true ourselves. So we have both a deep longing for and a deep fear of intimacy. But here's the thing. What if you're already completely known? All the good, all the joys, all the successes, all the victories, all the hopes, and all the bad, all the fears, all the failures, all the regrets, and yet you're completely loved. What if that were possible? Jesus says to this woman, it's amazing. They have this amazing conversation. You can't believe this is right in the middle of the Bible. Jesus says to this woman, go and get your husband. It's like, and she says, I have no husband. And Jesus says to her, you're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. I mean, it's just like, you know, that's quite a full-on conversation. They've just met. It's a shocking line. I mean, that's a life of pain, regret, broken dreams, summed up in a few words. I don't know, some of you here might have experienced the pain of a relationship breakup. It's hard, it's tough. Imagine going through five of those, and it's not just a relationship, it's a marriage which is breaking up. Imagine what that is like. I mean, you might not have had five bad marriages, but I think we've all have done five things we deeply regret. You know, five choices we wish we could make again. But what I find fascinating about this is that Jesus doesn't spend a long time focusing on what's gone wrong in the past. You know, Jesus, you can't shock Jesus. He's never going to turn around to you and say, you did what? With the person in accounts? That person. He's not going to do that. He knows. I mean, that's the strange thing. There's no need for pretense or pretending when it comes to Jesus, because he knows you inside out. He knows your end from the beginning. That's why, you know, sometimes we pretend with God, but there's no need, because he knows you inside out. And what I love about this passage is he doesn't spend ages like going to the woman saying, okay, we're gonna workshop this now. Marriage number one, what went wrong there? Let's talk it through. Oh, marriage number two, still went for the same sort of guy. You know, you thought you would have learned from marriage. Number three, what happened with number three? I don't even know. Marriage number four, well, that was probably more your fault than his. You know, that's not what he does. He knows she doesn't need a lecture. She needs living water. You know, sometimes we focus on the things that are going wrong, and you can spend days talking about the things that are going wrong. But more often than not, the things that are going wrong are symptoms of the real issue. This woman's looking for love in all the wrong places. And Jesus knows if he can move that and focus her on him, if she can worship in spirit and in truth, then that's all going to change. It's fascinating. And I just think it's amazing that she starts this conversation, they have this conversation, and she's probably thinking, this is the thing that she would have been most inclined to conceal, most inclined not to speak about. Like, this is the most shameful thing in my life. And Jesus brings it right out into the front. And it looks quite harsh. It looks like a bit firm from Jesus. But actually, there's a real kindness to it. Because he's saying, look, we can actually relate. There's no need to pretend. I know your deepest, darkest secret, and I'm still here speaking to you. I haven't run away. I started the conversation. I'm engaging with you. I want to lead you to the truth. I want you to lead you into a relationship with me. What Jesus offers is so powerful. And it's amazing because it's a gift. Jesus says this is God's gift to you. And the whole point of a gift to you is that it's free. It doesn't cost you. But that doesn't mean there's not a cost. The giver pays the price. The giver counts the cost. And we know that that's what Jesus did on the cross, that he paid the price for us so that we might come to know God. And then there's this amazing thing. As this conversation ends, the woman says, you know, we're waiting for the Messiah. And she's talking to Jesus. It's amazing. We're waiting for the Messiah, and she's talking to Jesus. And Jesus kind of says, you know, I'm him. It's me. And I think that's a remarkable thing. I don't know if you know, this is one of the strongest claims to Jesus' divinity in the whole of the Gospels. Who does he say he's the Messiah to? Political leaders? Religious leaders? A king? He's silent before Herod, but to this woman who's had 5 marriages, at a well on the outskirts of the village, he says, look, no one else knows this yet, but let me tell you something. It's really exciting. I mean, they're going to get crazy when they find out the disciples. I haven't even told them yet, but let me tell you, I'm the Messiah. It's amazing. That's how he treats her. He's the one that she's been searching for. He's the one who makes it possible to know God. He takes all her guilt and shame away. He was willing to pay any price to rescue her, to rescue you, who through his cross and resurrection makes it possible for you to be completely known and completely loved. And when I glimpsed that truth, it transformed my life. I realized he is who he says he is, and it freed me to love and hope in a new way. And it doesn't just leave you there. That's just what I want. One more thing I want to say tonight is when you encounter him, it's utterly life transforming. So this woman starts the day ostracized from her community. I mean, did anyone here grow up in a small town? Small village? It's okay. A few more. Okay, quite a few. If you've had 5 husbands in a small village, are you going to be popular? Probably not. She's not. She's going to the well at midday because she's ostracized, because they're not happy with her. She's probably an outcast effectively in her community because of the way she's lived her life. That's how she starts the day. She goes to the well. She has this conversation with this guy at the well, Jesus, and she goes back. She's so excited. She says to the whole village, I met this guy at the well. Do you think he could be the Messiah? So she starts the day ostracized from her community, failing morally. She ends the day one of the most compelling people to speak about Jesus in the whole of the Gospels. Do you know, almost everyone in that village came to believe that he was the Messiah because of her testimony. Isn't that amazing? So because you're fully known and you can be fully loved, anything's possible, really. And you can go from 0 to 60. You can go from feeling like you're on the outside and not sure about the whole thing and just trying to work it out, and I don't really know what I believe, but I think Jesus might be the Messiah. Let's go and tell some people about it. And that can happen in about 2 hours or a day. I find that fascinating. That makes me so excited to know Jesus. That makes me so excited to see what he does. Because what he does is completely unexpected. He is completely unshockable. And when you encounter him, it completely and utterly transforms your life. Now, you might be here tonight, and a friend might just have brought you along, and you might be thinking, oh, that's very interesting. But, you know, things to do, places to go, it's just interesting. It's not any more than that. And that's fine. If you feel that way, thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Feel free to come again next week. We'd love to see you. Stick around, have a coffee. You might be here tonight and you might think, yeah, I want to be like that woman. Yeah, I've made 5 mistakes that I regret, and actually, I feel like if I was in this story, I would be nervous about going close to Jesus at the well because of what he might say, because I don't feel clean enough, because I don't feel perfect enough, because I don't feel holy enough. But actually, I do want to encounter him. I do want to place my trust in him. I want to know him. I might not have it all together. I might not have sorted it all out in my head yet, but I want to start that journey of following him. And if that's you, maybe we could all just pray. And could you just close your eyes? And if that's you tonight, and you know, it might be for the first time ever in your life, and you think, look, this is an opportunity. I don't want to miss this opportunity. Because I see now in this passage just what a difference it could make to each and every day of my life that comes after this point. And I don't want to go another day without taking a step towards him. It might be, say, for the first time, or it might be that something's happened in the last couple of terms, in the last year, and you know that this is a commitment you need to make again tonight. So I'm just going to pray this prayer. It's just sorry, thank you, please. And maybe you'd pray this in the quietness of your heart if you're in one of those two groups. So Lord, I'm sorry for the things I've done wrong. I'm sorry that I've gone my own way. And I want to turn back towards you tonight. I want to turn to you, maybe for the first time tonight. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you that because of him, I can be completely known and completely loved. Thank you for his cross. Thank you that he died for me. And please, would you fill me? Would you guide me? Would you lead me on? Would you transform me? In Jesus' name, amen.